From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to Conversations with David, the one and only David Icke. David is going to be presenting what probably is going to be his farewell 9-hour presentation called Awaken at Wembley Stadium in October, October 25th. So get your tickets ready, folks, because this may be your last opportunity to see David in such a forum. Good morning, David.
Morning, Maria.
How are you doing today?
I'm okay, yeah. Getting on, you know, getting on as we always do.
Right, exactly. David, there's so much going on, I don't know where to begin, but I have to tell you that all these posters you're putting up on Facebook and social media, I'm flipping them over to everywhere. And I look at that, and I have posted several times, especially with all these reports finally coming out on the pedophilia in the UK, the European Union, etc.
Right.
And constantly reminding people, David Icke named these names 20 years ago. And that's when everybody said, you were crazy. So maybe they just need to listen to more crazy people.
Yeah, well, you see, in a crazy world, crazy is normal. Crazy sees intelligence as crazy. It's an inverted world, and so you just have to get used to it. You know, if you're saying things that are not crazy in a crazy world, you know, don't expect a pat on the back. Expect a lot of abuse, really. What happened was back in 1998 and earlier. In the 90s, I started coming across information of a very, very significant political paedophile network, which involved prime ministers like a guy called Ted Heath. And I I did a lot of research in America on the same subject, and Father George Bush, you know, infamous paedophile to anyone who has researched this. The whole thing came together in terms of the fact that these major people in power invariably connect to three things. One is secret societies, not surprisingly. Another is Satanism and satanic ritual. And the other one is paedophilia. And paedophilia and satanic ritual actually connect. For reasons I go into in the books. But then I met a lady in 97-98 called Christine Fitzgerald. Christine Fitzgerald was a close friend of Princess Diana for 9 years. And for some reason, out of the blue, I was invited to go and meet some people at the House of Lords, the Houses of Parliament in London. When I went there, there was just a few people, and we had a chat, and there was a lady there who said some very interesting things. Remember, this is not long after it happened. Said some very interesting things about Diana and her death and other things about her life and connections to the royal family. And afterwards, I obviously went over and said, you know, how do you know this? And she said, well, my best friend was Diana's best friend. For 9 years, and I think she'll talk to you. So I said, absolutely, go for it. And a few days later, we met a lady called Christine Fitzgerald. She was an alternative healer, worked in a clinic in London. And Diana, who was open to all this stuff, she went to the clinic for various alternative treatments. And what Christine Fitzgerald told me has all proved to be accurate. One of the things she told me, and I've still got the tapes, is that Jimmy Savile, this BBC entertainer and the disc jockey, was an incredibly sleazy character who was very close to the royal family, and Diana couldn't stand the man. And in fact, the royal family had used Savile as a mediator between Diana and Prince Charles when the marriage was breaking down. And we're talking here, Maria, a sleazy aging disc jockey.
Right.
And of course, what Christine Fitzgerald also told me in that meeting at the end of the 90s was that Jimmy Savile was a paedophile and a necrophiliac. He had a thing about sex with dead bodies. And one of the things that Jimmy Savile was well known for was volunteering to be a porter at a hospital in a place called Leeds in Britain. And it was clear that he volunteered for that job because it gave him access to the mortuary. So this is the kind of character we're dealing with. And so all these years later, what she told me about Savile hit the public eye just a few years ago after he died. And I remember when he died, I put on the website about the fact that he was a paedophile and a necrophiliac and all that, and I got a lot of abuse for, you know, saying these things about this nice man. And a few years later, bang, it was all out in the open, and he was obviously one of the most record-breaking paedophiles in certainly in British history. But he was more than that. He was a procurer of children for the rich and famous, including Prime Minister Ted Heath. And then that brings us into the royal family. Jimmy Savile, by his own words, was introduced to the inner circle, the inner circle of the British royal family, by a man called Lord Mountbatten. Lord Mountbatten is a known paedophile, he was very well known for it. Anyone who researched this subject. So you've got a paedophile, Maria, who introduces this paedophile procurer of children for paedophiles into the inner circle of the royal family, where he became very close to Prince Philip and very close to Prince Charles. And then when this whole thing broke and the truth about Savile came out, although, you know, not the biggest truth, of course, the royal family has never been talked about. You know, they keep arresting C-list and B-list celebrities over here for historical child abuse. But the royal family, of course, they're just left alone, even though the evidence is unbelievable. And then you go to the next level of it, which is that anyone who gets close to the royal family or prime ministers is checked out in great detail by British intelligence, by MI5. And here you had what is clear now on the inside, a man in Jimmy Savile who they knew what he was doing. And British intelligence would certainly have known what he's doing. Mind you, that's a nest of paedophiles as well. And yet he was allowed to not only be in the inner circle of the royal family, but he was a very, very close friend of Margaret Thatcher and spent New Year with her, so something like 10 years running during her premiership. And of course, the stuff that that I uncovered in the late 90s pointed to a paedophile network that actually went into 10 Downing Street and the Thatcher government. And now that's coming out.
Right.
That was in The Biggest Secret, like 1998 that came out.
Right. So let me ask you this. Does this all, now that it's all coming out, do you feel vindicated?
Well, it's nice to be... To have what I did in the 1990s acknowledged as having validity, but the most important thing for me is that as this comes out, people are starting to become more streetwise and less naive, because what I came across when I put that information out, including in The Biggest Secret, exposing this Prime Minister Ted Heath as a paedophile, a child torturer, and a serial child killer, and that passage was read to him days after publication, and all he said was by a journalist, and all he said was that David Icke must be mad, and nothing happened. He lived for 7 years afterwards, never came near me. In the Biggest Secret, I also name a guy called Lord McAlpine as a paedophile.
Mm-hmm.
Lord McAlpine was the Svengali in the Thatcher government. Thatcher Svengali. I mean, that was just a nest of paedophiles, the Thatcher regime, all those years. And of course, what happened is that after the whole Savile thing happened, Lord McAlpine's name came up. He was not named in a BBC interview by someone who said that he had abused them, but they didn't use that bit in the interview. And yet the BBC, not naming him, paid out an enormous figure in libel damages. That then the independent station over here, ITV, some presenter handed Cameron, the Prime Minister, in a live interview, a piece of paper with a list of alleged paedophiles on from the internet, political paedophiles. No one could see what was on the paper, but McAlpine's name was on the list. And even though no one saw it, ITV paid McAlpine a vast amount of money in libel damages. Then there were people on Twitter who didn't name him, who paid out libel damages to him, and in 1997-98, I named him in The Biggest Secret. Nothing. When the whole story broke again, in the period that I'm talking about, the last few years, when he was getting those libel damages, I named him again as a paedophile, openly on my website. Never came near me. Because they know that I know, and therefore they don't want to go to court with something like that, with all that would come out, not just about individuals, but about the network.
Right, I find that odd.
Yeah, so, and the thing is, Maria, that America's just like that. Washington is another absolute nest of paedophilia and political paedophilia. Not just the Father George Bush, but one after the other. And of course, the some of the background came out a few years ago now in the book about the Franklin Savings and Loan scam. Run by a guy called Lawrence King, who was then exposed as being like Savile, a procurer of children and what have you for the rich and famous in the Republican Party. I mean, Lawrence King was such a big Republican. He sang the national anthem at the Republican conventions in 84 and 88, and he was running a paedophile procurement ring. And so it's happening all over the place, and there's a reason for it, which we can maybe get into now or another time. There's a reason why paedophilia is so absolutely massive in the so-called upper levels of society. And I did an interview actually this morning with a guy who was part of the team, the production team that made the documentary Unlawful Killing about the inquest into Diana's death, which was a complete stitch up. And it was made with money from Mohammed Al-Fayed, but Al-Fayed has never put it out because he says he can't get the insurance for it. I've seen it, and it should be seen by everyone. And if it was seen by the British public as a whole, then the royal family would be in serious trouble. But one of the things I was talking to him about was, again, Christine Fitzgerald. This is an interesting aspect to this, because, again, the naivety is the royal family would never do that. The royal family would never have someone killed. Well, yes, they would. I mean, the royal family lines going right back in a so-called history. I've been killing people en masse and individually all the way through. And when I talked to Christine Fitzgerald about Diana's time with the royals at the time of the Charles marriage and before, it was horrific what she was telling me. And there was one passage which I can read to you, which is in the book, and it concerns a man called Barry Manicky. What happened is that when the marriage was breaking down between Diana and Prince Charles, she started a relationship with a private detective called Barry Manicky. And then Manicky suddenly died in a what was said to be a motorcycle accident in 1988. And then by 1990, she was having a relationship with a guy called Captain James Hewitt, who is almost certainly the father of Prince Harry, by the way. If you see Hewitt and Prince Harry, a picture of James Hewitt as a young man, put it next to a picture of Prince Harry. It's unbelievable. It's moving towards twins. Anyway, at this time in 1990, when she was having this relationship with Hewitt the years after Barry Manicky was killed, Christine Fitzgerald described to me what happened one day when Diana came rushing into her clinic in an almost inconsolable state. And this is the direct quote from the tape of the interview. She, Diana, was crying hysterically. And I said, "What's the matter?" "You know, it was dog's died stuff, bottom lip out, full sob. She came galloping through the door. I gave her rescue remedy, clutched her, hugged her, calmed her down, and said, 'Now tell me what's going on. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. They killed him. They killed him,' she sobbed. I said, 'Who did they kill?' And she told me that about the affair with the detective, Barry Manicky, and how he was decapitated on a motorbike, and how she thought it was a terrible accident. But now she knows the royal family killed him because Prince Charles's senior detective had just told her that if she didn't call it with Hewitt, the same would happen to him. He told her she should not think that she was indispensable either." This is the mentality that you're dealing with. And, you know, Christine Fitzgerald said that friendly people, there was a man from the SAS, she mentioned, the Special Air Services, a really elite regiment in the British military, and what she called friendly people from MI6, who used to leave messages and letters for Diana at the clinic that she would pick up. And they were warning her that her life was in danger. And because the Paul Burrell, Diana's butler, revealed that she wrote a letter, a handwritten letter, in which she said that my husband is planning to kill me in a car accident. And that when that came out years after The Biggest Secret, I was not surprised at all, because Christine Fitzgerald told me all about that all those years before. So, the idea that Diana died in an accident is ridiculous. You know, I've been to Paris twice when I was researching this and walking the route and what have you. There are 17 traffic cameras between the Ritz Hotel, where she left in the car, and the Pont d'Alma tunnel where she died. 17 surveillance traffic cameras. Every single one was not working that night. There's one right over the entrance which would have showed you everything that happened, but that wasn't working either. And what most people don't know is that, these radio hams that listen into police messages and stuff like that, there was one sitting on a bench right next to the Eiffel Tower, which is literally just across the river from the Pont d'Alma tunnel. And he didn't realize the significance of it until he got home and put the television on and saw the news. But in that period of Diana leaving the Ritz to the Pont d'Alma tunnel and what followed, all the police communications were switched off in central Paris in the same period that traffic cameras weren't working. So it's just so blatant that she was murdered.
Right.
And she knew where the bodies were buried. That was the thing. She knew where the bodies were buried in terms of the royal family. And she'd shown that she was willing to go for it and talk about it. And they wanted rid of her.
What do you think about the new princess in the UK, the one that married... that married the other prince? Do you think she's in danger? Do you think she knows what she got into?
I don't think she knows what she's got into. It doesn't come across like that. Diana certainly did. I mean, Diana, Christine Fitzgerald was telling me, wanted out. She was basically imprisoned at a place called Clarence House, which was the Queen Mother's house. Prince Charles lives there now. And Diana called... the Queen Mother, who was, you know, promoted as the nation's lovely grandmother, she described her as evil. I mean, she was a massive satanic witch, the Queen Mother. And so she wanted out, but they wouldn't let her.
Didn't Diana also say they were a family of reptiles?
Yeah, well, what happened with Christine Fitzgerald was interesting, Maria, because I'd been in America and I'd been traveling from place to place, talking to nobody in those days, but a different city every day, going round and round and round. And in a period of about 15 days, I met 12 different people in different parts of America who told me the same story, that how they'd seen people in humans, they thought, suddenly switch into a reptilian form and then back again.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back here, and literally about 5 minutes from where I'm sitting now, I was scheduled to meet a lady who said that she was brought up in a big Freemasonic abusive situation as a child, and was eventually forced to marry a Satanist who used to set up satanic rituals for who did she mention? Ted Heath and people like that. So Satanism and paedophilia are interconnected for reasons I could get to in a sec. But anyway, I was meant to meet her to talk about the satanic ritual and the connection to Ted Heath, and I'd never mentioned to her at all what I'd been experiencing in America. I literally just got back and went straight over there. And at the end of the conversation about Heath and satanic experiences, I was just finishing my cup of tea and I was putting it down, and I turned away to leave, and I just had a throwaway line. I don't know, you know, life's so strange. I you know, I keep meeting people that tell me they've seen people turn into reptiles.
Right.
And I didn't see her, but I heard this kind of breath. And I turned around, and she's holding her chest, gasping for breath. And I said, what's the matter? She said, oh, my God. She said, I wasn't going to tell you this, because I thought even you might find this strange. But when she said that when... she lived at a place called Burnham Beeches, just outside London, not far from Windsor Castle, one of the royal palaces. And it's owned, Burnham Beeches. It's an area of copse and woodland and clearings. And it's owned by the City of London, you know, the financial district,
right.
One of the great centers for the global cabal on planet Earth. And she said her husband was the warden of Burnham Beeches and lived in a big house there with her. And he set up satanic rituals in the beaches at night. And she said one night she was walking in the darkness, and she saw a light in the distance through the trees. And she walked, and you know, kind of very carefully, keeping her head down to see what it was. And when she got closer, she saw that there was a satanic ritual going on. There was a circle, and they were all in robes. And leading it was Ted Heath, the Prime Minister at the time. He was Prime Minister at the time. He was Prime Minister of Britain from 1970 to 74. He was the one that signed us into the European Union. And next to him was his Chancellor of the Exchequer, a guy called Anthony Barber, in the circle. And she said, as I watched, he was leading the he was leading the ritual and the chanting and stuff. And then he said, suddenly, he changed into a reptile figure, grew about 2 feet, which is an absolutely common theme that people say when they experience this.
Right.
And she said, first of all, she said the thing that shocked her most is that when it happened, no one else in the circle showed any reaction whatsoever, as if it was the most natural thing in the world.
Right.
And she said that when he took reptile form, he started speaking, she said, in a voice that was a bit like, she described it as a bit like the old transatlantic telephone calls, where there's gaps between words, as if it was coming from a long way away. Then, after I'd done that, I had the experience with Christian Fitzgerald, and we're talking about Diana, the Windsors, and Jimmy Savile, and all this stuff. And then suddenly she said to me, do you know what Diana used to call the Windsors? And I said, no. And she said she used to call them the lizards, and she used to say they're not human. And I hadn't told her anything about my experiences and what people I'd met, so I played dumb. I said, what lizards? What do you mean? And then she said, well, the Windsors are a reptile hybrid bloodline, and they can take either human or reptilian form because they have this dual DNA, and they have what she called the knowledge of the micro frequencies that can allow them to take one form or another. And that was in the conversation.
Wow.
In which she told me an enormous amount of stuff that's now proved to be absolutely correct. She pointed out that very, very few people, even within the royal circle, have any idea of who the royals really are, because it's so compartmentalized.
Wow. Who they are. It's more like what they are. David, yeah. We're going to take a short break. When we get back, I got lots more I want to talk to you about. So stay with us. David and I will be right back. Okay, David and I are back. David, I know you have one more quote that you wanted to read on that, and then tie this into Gaza, which people probably think there's no connection.
Well, this is another quote from The Biggest Secret, direct quote of Christine Fitzgerald, when she's talking about the reptilian nature of the royal family and the Queen Mother. She said this: the Queen Mother, now there's a serious piece of wizardry. The Queen Mother is a lot older than people think. She was alive at the time. To be honest, the royal family hasn't died for a long time. They've just metamorphosized. It's a sort of cloning, but in a different way. They take pieces of flesh and rebuild the body from one little bit. Because it's a lizard, because it's cold-blooded, it's much easier for them to do this Frankenstein stuff than it is for us. The different bodies are just different electrical vibrations, and they've got the secret. They've got the secret of the microcurrents. It's so micro, so specific, these radio waves that actually create the bodies. These are the energies I work with when I'm healing. They know the vibration of life because they're cold-blooded, they're reptiles. They have no wish to make the life, the earth, the perfect harmony it could be, or to heal the earth from the damage that's been done. The earth's been attacked for zeons by different extraterrestrials. It's been like a football for so long. The place was a bus stop for many different aliens, and these aliens could cope with anything, including noxious gases. They're landing all the time and coming up from the bowels of the earth. They looked like reptiles originally, but they look like us when they get out now through the electrical vibration, that life key I talked about. They can manifest how they want to. All the real knowledge has been taken out and shredded and put back in another way. the Queen Mother is, quote, chief toad in this part of Europe, and they have people like her in each continent. Most people, the hangers-on, don't know, you know, about the reptiles. They're just in awe of these people because they're so powerful.
Crazy. So let's go over to Gaza and what's been happening there, you know, which seems to be, kind of looks like Ferguson, Missouri. And, of course, the Zionist agenda based on lies going in and pretty much wiping out most of all life support in Gaza.
Yeah, it's just part of the step-by-step genocide. I mean, you look at the land occupied by Palestinians from 1948 to now, and it's just disappearing. And you know, again, what's happened, I think, with a lot of people with regard to Gaza this time is it has been a wake-up call in the sense that they've seen scales of destruction, scales of empathy-deleted, compassion-deleted horrors. And it's woken the people up, a lot of people up, to the scale of evil that we're dealing with. You know, one of the biggest the problems that I've seen over the years with humanity's ability to grasp what's happening is they can't grasp the scale of evil that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they explain away expressions of that evil every day as random events, not connected. It's all connected. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing now is an attempt to lead us through into World War III. I've been saying since way, way, way back that the plan was to bring the West into a war with Russia and China. And, of course, we're now seeing the demonization of Russia as a result of the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the claim that Russia was involved in taking down the Malaysian jet just has not stood up to the evidence.
Right.
And it's very clear that it was actually taken down by Ukraine jets. And to demonize Russia.
Right.
But Russia got radar and satellite stuff out very quickly, and it basically blew it out of the water. And you see how quiet America and Ukraine have gone on that now, because they know that it won't wash.
Right.
And interestingly, Ukraine started attacking the Russian separatists in the area of the crash site, and that has stopped the crash investigators doing a proper investigation. But what has come out is that the plane was shot with bullets rather than a missile. Both sides of the cockpit, it's part of this whole move towards World War III, because this ISIS organization has been 100% funded, trained, and armed by the United States and Britain and Israel, and through Saudi Arabia and Qatar, that are 51st states of the United States, to become this demonic, horrific army that is causing mayhem and terror in Iraq and elsewhere. And what they're doing is creating an enemy which they can then say we have to fight, and suddenly they have a war in that area of the world which they've been planning for a long, long time. You know, when you look at Israel, it's a sliver of land of less than 8 million people, and it's got one of the best equipped militaries in the world, including a nuclear weapons arsenal. And that's not, you know, been there to protect Israel. That's been there for other reasons all along. And what we're seeing now, I mean, when you think of the irony, although so symbolic, that the airstrikes by the American Air Force on ISIS targets, it's American weapons shooting at American weapons.
Right.
And because what happened is that America left all that a massive amount of high technology weaponry in Iraq, and of course the ISIS, as they've taken over more and more land, have taken over more and more of this high-tech weaponry. You know what's interesting? They know how to work it.
Right.
What?
Right.
They know how to work it. And the other thing is, if you notice, in all these things, whether it's Al-Qaeda, ISIS, ISIL, Islamic State, whatever it calls itself today, they never attack Israel.
Right.
They always attack each other along Sunni and Shiite lines in terms of Muslims or Muslims in general. And it's so so blatant, and it's something that is very clearly on an agenda for a very massive conflict in that area of the world, with designs on using that conflict to take the whole place over.
Right.
And
well,
to break it up into the kind of units of control that have been on the agenda from the start.
Right. Well, I noticed on your website you talk about a Middle Eastern Union. Is that their goal?
Well, what they want is European unions everywhere, because they want an end to the nation state. They want countries broken up into regions, and because that de-unifies any unified response to the edifice of power above. So what they want, and the maps exist, for goodness sake. They want to break the countries of Europe up into regions, and they've got maps that showing what they plan to do. The same with the North American Union they want to bring in, and in fact the Americas Union. They want a union for the whole of the Americas in the end. Both Father George Bush, Bill Clinton, both called for that in their period in office, and they're agenda people, obviously. And so in the area of Australia and the Far East, there's APEC, Asia Pacific Economic Union. There's ASEAN, another economic union. They want to turn that into a Pacific Union, a la European Union in that part of the world. They already have, of course, an African Union,
right?
Which was set up some years ago. And they do want a Middle East Union, yes, because what that does, you see, if there's a few of you and you want to control the many, you have to centralize decision making, and the more you centralize, the more power you have, the more power the few have over the rest.
Right.
So we started off with tribes, where the people in the tribe made decisions about the tribe. Then lots of tribes were brought together in what were called nations, and now a few people are dictating to all the former tribes.
Right.
Then in Europe, we've got the European Union. Now all the nations are grouped together, and a few people are dictating to all the nations, and they want eventually a world government that is the top of the power structure, or the power structure you can see, and then under that they want these unions all over the world that are answering to the diktats of the world government. It's a structure of control that people like George Orwell actually understated in
right.
terms of the level of control that
right.
they are planning.
Well, you know, this morning I saw an article that the European Union's, one of their think tanks, is talking about being able to put down people that go on strike or protesters with military force.
Yep, absolutely. That's
what
they want. And, you know, what we're seeing in Ferguson is an expression of the plan. I mean, you know, I've been saying for years now how, I mean, we've all experienced it, but in America and in Britain and elsewhere, this very blatant transformation over the last 20, 25 years or a bit more of the personality of law enforcement. There's always been bad apples. There's always been psychopaths. There's always been crooks. But what we've seen over the last 25 years or more, yeah, and more and more as we get closer to now, is a systematic policy of recruiting law enforcement personnel, not on the ability on their ability to do the job, but on their personality type. So what's happened is when a job's come vacant or more jobs have been made, they are recruiting psychopathic people. and narcissistic, sociopathic people. And so when one of the old school policemen, one of the old school cops or coppers, as we call them here, leaves, he's replaced or she's replaced by one of these personality types. And what it's real simple. If you employ psychopaths, you get psychopathic behavior.
Right.
If you employ psychopaths with psychopathic behavior and you give them tasers and guns, well, you don't really have to make much happen after that, because it's a perpetual motion machine of subjugation and violence against the population. And then when you have these various incidents, I mean, these SWAT teams, how many people have they killed and maimed by going to the wrong house?
Right. Or dogs. Let's not leave that.
And cop stuff, really, right. Because... you know, they employ psychopaths, but they don't employ intelligent psychopaths. And when you have these incidents and then you see that nothing's done about them. I mean, we had a guy here, a Brazilian electrician, who was held down on a tube train and shot 7 times in the head at close range by a police marksman while other policemen held him down, on the basis that he was a suspected terrorist. It turns out he was nothing of the kind. He was an electrician. Where I'm going with this is that the guy that pulled the trigger, I mean, how many times do you have to shoot someone in the head to kill them? We're talking 7 times.
Right.
Psychopathic behavior of most extreme kind. What happened to this guy? He got promotion. So when the psychopaths see that they're basically untouchable,
right?
I mean, they were trying to, like crazy, to protect this guy in Ferguson.
Right.
Until they were forced to name him. That just adds to the extremes of behavior. I can do what I like.
Exactly, with impunity and immunity. Well, you know, I mean, to me, the situation is simple. Just indict the cop. They've tried everything, including the National Guard. But one of the good things I think that's coming out of this, David, is a few Congress people have already started talking, and now Obama, of course, he wants to always be on the right side of history, late to the party, talking about demilitarizing our police. You know, last year alone, the police killed 400 Americans in the United States.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And you know, that figure's going to go up and up and up until this is addressed, because of the psychopaths that they are recruiting. And you know, one of the things, one of the personality traits of the psychopath, sociopath, and narcissist is when people challenge them or won't accept their omnipotence, they basically explode. And how many YouTube videos do you see where someone is just saying, look, give me the law that you are stopping me on. Give me the law that you are arresting me for. Just tell me the law. And the taser comes out because someone is challenging the omnipotence of this psychopath, and they won't have it. And of course, the biggest trait of the psychopath that creates the psychopath is lack of empathy, the inability to empathize and have empathy with the consequences of your actions for other people. Therefore, there's no fail-safe mechanism. Empathy is the fail-safe mechanism of human behavior, because if you can put yourself in the position of people that you are affecting, well, that empathy will stop you going to extremes in terms of the way you treat them. No empathy means there are no limits. There is no fail-safe.
Right, and when these cops get caught, you know, their chiefs always say the same thing. They just did what they're trained to do.
Exactly, and that is what they are trained to do.
Right.
And when you look at the training, we've got two major elite regiments in the British military called the Parachute Regiment and the SAS, Special Air Services. And a few years ago, well, many years ago now, they did a series, I think it was on the BBC, of how they trained people to become members of the Parachute Regiment, and how they weeded out the people that were not of the required kind. Mm-hmm. And by this time, I'd done a lot of research into mind control and manipulating people to take on certain personalities. And I was watching these programs. It was classic mind control. Mm-hmm. What they were doing was training people to be psychopaths. That's what they were doing. And now it's moved to the military. I mean, you know, I mean, just look a few years ago, Maria, say the 1990s even, the idea that the American police forces would be going around in tanks and armored vehicles with
right.
military weaponry and looking absolutely like, you know, troops in the battlefield mm-hmm. would have been like, no, never. But look at it and how right. fast it's come in.
Absolutely. Well, they used 9/11 as the perfect excuse.
Well, that's where it all started. Really, that was the big red button being pressed that allowed all that's followed to happen. Because you take 9/11 out of this sequence of events, we would not be anywhere near where we are now because they could not have justified it.
Absolutely.
And so I say to people that believe the official version of 9/11, well, who has benefited from 9/11? That's the big question when any event happens. Who benefits from this? And who benefits from me believing the official story? Well, who benefited from 9/11? The people that died? No. The families? No. Who benefited? Only one group of people. Anyone that wanted to launch the war on terror and the war against human freedom and privacy. That's... They're the winners from 9/11 and the only ones.
Uh-huh. Well, you talked about...
Companies, of course.
Right, you said there were 17 cameras in that tunnel where Diana was killed. Imagine how many cameras there were at the Pentagon, and yet we have no film.
Exactly. I mean, you know, there's cameras going up in extraordinary numbers with extraordinary speed. All kinds of cameras, face recognition cameras, and everything. And yet, when something happens that
right, the camera's
the system
not working.
Doesn't want you to see,
right.
they're not working. Do you know, I just mentioned about the Brazilian electrician. Mm. Well, all over the tube underground train network in London, all over, every station, cameras everywhere. Guess which ones weren't working the day he was shot?
Right.
The ones where he was shot.
Right.
I mean, it's a joke. You know. Remember the London tube train bombings,
right.
and there's a bomb on a bus.
Right.
Well, buses, these London buses now, they have surveillance cameras on them. Guess which bus had a camera not working that day?
Right.
The one that was bombed. You know,
right.
I mean, it's
very
just
convenient.
Pathetic. And how the how mainstream journalists can look themselves in the mirror when ignoring this stuff is it shocking to me.
Mm, absolutely. All right, David, we got a few more minutes I wanted to touch on. What do you think about this new Ebola crisis going around the world?
Well, my jury's out on that, and in the sense that it's one of two things. Either it's been put out there on purpose, or it's being massively overblown to frighten people. But I mean, for sure, when it comes to control and people accepting, even calling for the control,
right.
then a deadly virus is perfect to justify the imposition of, in effect, martial law type situations where people are told where they can be and where they can't be, and,
right.
and the fact that they can't assemble and all these things.
Right.
It's perfect. And one thing's for sure, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds created the World Health Organization. And this lady, Margaret Chan, who's the head of the World Health Organization, whenever she opens her mouth, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers are talking.
Right.
So whatever she says is what they want people to believe. It's a joke. they set up these organizations like WHO and the World Trade Organization, etc., so that they've got control of these areas of society under one roof. Anything the World Health Organization says is to be taken with a gigantic pinch of salt.
Right. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, and I guess I'll talk to you either before or after Wembley. So,
That's right. Yeah, and it's going to be a fantastic event.
Absolutely. Well, take good care. We'll talk soon, David.
You too, mate. Bye.
Bye. There you have it. Okay. Tomorrow, Dave McGowan joins me. Thanks for supporting the show. I'll see you guys then.